All right. Hello. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. You're listening to The Real World. The Real World, if you don't already know, if you're not an every other week listener, is the UBC Film Society's radio segment. We talk about all things film related from 4 to 5, as usual. I'm Lily. And here is my co-host.
I'm Emma.
All right. We're going to start off with a couple ads, and then we'll be back talking about all things 90s today. So we'll be right back.
DOXA Documentary Film Festival returns May 2nd to 12th, 2024. Audiences of all ages are invited to 10 days of curiosity and critical thought in film. For 22 years, DOXA continues to present both short and feature films from across Canada and the globe, representing some of the best in documentary cinema. This year, DOXA is once again returning to local theaters in Vancouver and will feature live discussions, workshops, and other industry networking events with filmmakers. Visit doxafestival.ca for tickets, and we hope to see you there.
Everything you take in is the first and the last time it will ever be that way. This is Kristen Carter, and my debut contemporary pop album, Full Bloom, is now yours to discover on all digital streaming platforms. The past few years have had me reflecting a lot on what it means to be resilient, patient, and joyful, much like a gardener. Full Bloom is a living garden of 12 songs that celebrates the beauty in the seasonal nature of life. My hope is that each time you listen, you'll hear things in a different glow of light that make them new all over again. You can find Full Bloom wherever you listen to music, or you can visit thekristencarter.com or follow at Kristen Carter Music on social media to learn more. Funded by Factor and Canada's private radio broadcasters.
By the way, this is somebody's favorite show! Hi, Dan Shakespeare here. You know, for most of the stuff that I play, you probably think that I'm much older, but you know what? Most of you are probably way off, because I'm only 23 years old. Tune in to The Shakespeare Show between noon and 1 p.m. on Wednesdays. It's songs from before the 1920s to alternative stuff today, plus jokes and riddles, all sorts of fun stuff. Just put any of it on your iTunes if you need to. Pretty soon it'll be coming out on albums.
Are you interested in playing, watching, or discussing all things cricket? Look no further than UBC's Cricket Club. Reach out to @AMSUBCCricketClub on Instagram to get connected today.
Really, when you think about it.
Okay, cricket. We'll be right on that. But this isn't a show about cricket. Again, this is The Real World on CITR 101.9 FM. We're talking about film today. And we're starting a series that we've been wanting to do for a little while, talking about all things 90s. Before we jump into it, we have to introduce our guests of the day. So, of course, Lily and Emma, your usual hosts, but we're also joined by Ava and Ella. You guys want to say hi?
Hi!
Thanks for the in sync hello. That was perfect. We're so excited to have them on today. We've got their artists as well. They're filmmakers, dancers in the room. So we're going to get some unique opinions. We'll see where it goes. Anyway, like I was saying, we're doing 90s and we're going to kind of do a series ongoing on The Real World, starting today with our first episode, going through films by the decade, like what was happening in that decade, some of our favorites, least favorites, who knows, we'll see. Not in any particular order. We're just doing 90s just for a fluke today. But we're pretty excited because the 90s were crazy. We can't cover it all, but we're going to cover as much as we can, kind of, like four favorites, I guess.
A couple of faves, you know?
There's too much to do. Like, we've been talking about it, like, we don't want to jam too much in there, but we'll try to give some recommendations, too. And we want to receive recommendations, too, if you want to send us fan mail. Please send us fan mail.
Please. Let's make it happen.
But yeah, then 90s saw a lot. We got, like, the first feature film for a lot of big directors. Quentin Tarantino, who we'll be talking about later, his first feature. He had a lot of features in this decade. But started in the 90s. Also, Paul Thomas Anderson, Noah Baumbach, Wes Anderson, Alexander Payne. We've talked about him. We've talked about Todd Haynes recently. Anyway, huge stuff happening in this decade. We wish we were alive, let me tell you. Also, a lot of CGI technology I was looking up, and a lot of rom-coms, the emergence of more LGBTQ plus mainstream cinema, creative horror. We'll talk about that too. That's just an overview, a little bit of what we might be talking about, but also just some huge things that happened in the industry.
Yeah.
But the first movie we want to talk about, we want to talk about Scream. And you've been looking into Scream a lot recently, right, Emma?
I have been writing a paper on it as well, but Scream is just, it's been my favorite, not my favorite, but one of my favorite movies for years. I love Scream so much. I remember, like, watching it the first time, seeing, like, Randy running around in his stupid little video store, like, just over-explaining films. I'm like, yeah.
I love the video store
scenes.
He's
so me.
Yeah, so. He is you. I can see that.
Thank you.
Yeah, as someone who's, like, not into horror, I would say this is, like, as much as I can handle, since it's, like, kind of a parody horror, but also, like, subscribes to, like, the conventions as well, but in a comedic way because it's kind of mocking the horror. But I have to say, I rewatched it just to, like, refresh my memory, and I was still muting at parts. Do you guys mute movies, like, if it gets too scary? Is that, like...
I'll, like, skip it. I don't have the guts.
Okay. Yeah. I do that, too. I'll skip. I'll also mute, but you can handle it, though, Emma, because you're into scarier stuff.
So. I'm going to be so real. The first time I saw it, I think I watched it when I was, like, 14. I barely got past the opening kill. Like, that was too much for me. Like, I remember that happened. I was like, I gotta go. And it took me, like, 2 weeks to come back to the movie.
Yeah.
So this was a long, drawn-out process to watch it the first time. But then I saw it, like, 4 times since. This is just such a like, fundamental movie for me.
Have you, like, noticed different things each time you see it? Or is it, like, reinforcing, like, ideas you already have?
I think, like, once you know who the killers are, it's kind of fun to go rewatch and be like, ah, I see what you're doing here. Like, all that sort of thing. I think, honestly, I just, like, costumes just become so much more apparent to me. Like, when you're watching, you're like, oh, my God. Like, they're kind of going crazy. Like, everyone's kind of dripped out. Like, I don't know.
The costumes?
Yeah.
Like being tells in some sort of way, or just literally you like the style?
I just like the style.
Okay, yeah.
And
same.
I guess there is, like, this through line that you can trace that whoever's Ghostface in the movie, in, like, Scream 1, 2, 3, all of them, they're going to be wearing plaid at some point. So there's just, like, this through line that's really fun to trace, like, through the other movies in the franchise. Be like, ah,
okay,
I know who you are.
I didn't notice that. Yeah, the outfits are cool, though.
Can you describe them a bit more? Because I haven't seen it.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I guess, like, especially, like, one character in particular, like, Tatum. She wears, like, all these fun outfits. Like, one in particular that I'm thinking of is, like, this, like, cropped sort of, like, football jersey. That's, like, a reference to A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Okay.
Mm. Like, Johnny Depp's character wears that. So there's a lot of that sort of, like, they're very aware of where they're coming from in the horror genre.
Yes.
But they're still, like, poking fun
and
at
it. And it makes sense, because if we didn't already mention this, this is directed by Wes Craven. Mm-hmm. It's 1996,
yes.
I believe. And he directed, like, some iconic creative horrors, mm-hmm. like A Nightmare on Elm Street. And also, like, literally so many different horrors are referenced throughout the film. Like, whether it's through outfits or just, like, explicitly, like, saying, quoting them or whatever, whatever. But, yeah, so that for... If you guys haven't seen it, we kind of start at the beginning. There's a really iconic opening scene with Drew Barrymore. She's, like, the first victim, basically. That's not giving anything away, okay? No one come at us. That's, like,
that's
literally,
like, first,
you've,
like,
all seen
minutes.
It. You've probably already seen it on, like, YouTube or TikTok, whatever you're on these days, if you haven't already watched the movie. But, yeah, so she's the first victim, and then we go through and, yeah, what did you call him? Ghostface?
Ghostface.
Okay, yeah, so this is our killer.
Yeah.
He's like the Michael Myers, like, he's the one going around. He's also got an iconic costume. I was laughing so hard because, so he wears this kind of, like, can you guys picture the costume? Like, you know, like, the iconic killer, like, he's wearing the mask, whatever. But he's also got this, like, robe thing going on. And it's got, like the ends kind of come apart. Like, how do you describe that? Like, it's like a
it's just so raggedy. Shown up in this cloak. It's like, oh,
yeah,
my
it's like a raggedy little cloak. And there's one scene where he, like, scares Neve Campbell's character in the bathroom. Yeah. And all of a sudden, you, like, see his boots appear. And then, like, his cloak falls.
He lowers his boots. Oh my god!
And it's all you can see, and you're like, "Yep, that's our killer."
Such a goofy costume.
And like this worst quality, like it's not a good quality fabric. Like it's nothing special. There's no like creepy. Like I don't know what you would do to like stitch it in a creepy way, but like it's very non-threatening. But yeah, it's funny. But I like, yeah, I like the way it mocks the horror. I love mm-hmm. the video store scenes where they're going through all the conventions of the horror. They're literally listing things that you'll see happen later in the movie. They're like, it's so predictable, all these horrors. Like, there's a formula that they follow. The three that I was thinking about are, do you talk at all in your essay or, like, was it a focus when they list the horror conventions, the three, like, the three things that must happen in a horror? Yeah. Do you guys, like, wait, do you guys have any guesses?
I remember that part.
Okay, wait, tell.
But not the specifics.
Okay, so there's the three conventions. One of them, don't have sex.
Don't have sex.
If you have sex in the horror movie, you die. Mm-hmm. Because, like, it's a huge part of the horror, I guess. Like, the repression of sexual activity and things like that.
Yeah.
And then we've also got don't drink or do drugs or you die. These are things that all of them follow. And then don't say you'll be right back because you won't be right back. So you get to see a lot of things like that, or like the classic running, the girl running up the stairs and you're like, why didn't you go through the door? And she just can't open the door. It's so frustrating.
I have a question for you guys. If you were a horror movie victim character, which like stereotypical representation would you be of like the classic like person who dies first versus like the couple that sneaks off to do what you just said, what they're not supposed to be doing? Like, who do you guys think would be, or like specifically in this film, like which victim would
that's such a good question. Emma, you're the final girl, come on.
That's so good. I was gonna be like, yeah, film nerd that dies like halfway through.
No, you're the final girl. You would be.
I appreciate it. I'm too scared.
I know, I would not be the final girl. I'm first to go, like fully. What do you guys think?
I don't know.
Are you into horror? Do you guys like it?
Personally, no.
Like quite afraid, I think.
Quite afraid.
I'm very scared.
Somewhat afraid.
But I'm thinking about what you just said. Like, it's interesting that the sex is like something, like it you'll see it in every film, every horror film, and it's always whoever has sex dies, and this like relationship between eroticism and death, and like it makes me think of like stereotypical monsters like Dracula or something like that, where they like, it's because it comes so close. Like they, it's almost like these two ideas like fraternize with each other, and that's why someone like, and this is why it happens. Like it just, I feel like that creates such an interesting tension, and I think it's apparent in other ways other than the sex. Like I'd have to, again, I don't really remember the movie, but I'm wondering like, I'm just wondering what you guys would think on any of that.
No, totally. Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. Do you have any thoughts on that specifically, Emma?
Yeah, no, I think it's, like, it's really interesting, like, as a through line, the kind of, like, oh, the, like, repression of sexuality, like, outside marriage in this very, like, prescribed manner that we kind of see, like, that's not only, like, prevalent in society, I guess. It's, like, oh, it's, like, it's only a thing that happens within marriage. Otherwise, it's bad, obviously, and these characters are, like, punished for expressing it in a way. It's, like, oh, yeah, you're, like, marked for death after you've had sex, which I guess is why Scream like kind of subverts that expectation at the end. I won't say too much about that, but that is also like another really interesting, not subtle, like they do mention it, but it's a really interesting subversion that they decide to go down that route. I think is really cool.
Yeah, I think they switch things up in a nice way, but they also like, they highlight those conventions that you see as like a line through all of them. Like this like a common concept, whatever, but that at the beginning of the film, Billy and Sydney's character, like these are, this is the couple that's dating. This is also like our final girl. Like she's our main character. And he's like trying to not pressure her into like doing anything because they're teenagers, they're in high school and stuff. But like he seems to want to be doing more sexually than what they are. But he's kind of like, I don't want to pressure you. I don't want you to like feel like this is enough. Like whatever. Like I'm going, good night kiss. Da da da. It's nothing too much. Like there's a little bit of like, wanting her to feel bad or like feel guilty for not doing more, but it's not too much. But then we get the entrance of the villain, like the killer, whatever, and we see this pattern a lot, that once the killer comes in, all this stuff surfaces, and in a lot of cases, the sexual repression and then like whatever is built around that in anger and frustration that is like tense but has been pushed deep down, once the killer enters the town, it's the same thing in Halloween, and it's the same thing in this movie, all of those things come to surface. And you get this one really good line from him. He's like, "You'll accuse me of being a murderer, but you won't even touch me." And he wasn't being so passive before the killer comes in. But then now the killer's here, they're stirring up all of these things, and all of these things are coming to the surface. And that's when, yeah, what you're saying, like, that there's a really important link between the correlation between the monster and the other that comes into horror films and the surfacing of things that are like considered abnormal or repressed feelings.
You're sounding like our English prof with Frankenstein, which was actually 1994.
So that also fits in. Oh my gosh.
We're experts on that.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. I forgot that was 90s.
Yeah.
We got to talk about that guy. Oh, we've over-talked that. We took the whole course. A whole third of it was on Frankenstein. But yeah, does that like... Totally. I feel like that's what you were saying.
I like how you framed that. Like the monster is like... works as some sort of catalyst for extremism. And it's not that these like sentiments didn't exist before he comes in. It's that they are kind of, they haven't been like nurtured in the proper way yet.
Yeah.
And I guess that it just exposes the monster in everyone, really.
Oh, yeah.
Like it's just.
It was all there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Once, again, this is like a trend that's been happening forever.
Yeah.
But once you come up to face with extremism, the only way you can react is an also extreme reaction for the pendulum to swing properly. And so it makes mm-hmm. sense that people are, all these vulnerabilities are coming out in these moments.
Totally. I really agree. Yeah. Like Dracula, Frankenstein, all of these like classic monstrous figures. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Any final thoughts? We're also going to play a little song from Scream.
From Scream, yeah.
How'd you choose the song?
It played so much.
It's not a hard pick.
A hard pick. I was like, yeah, okay, Red Right Hand. In just every movie, like, needle drop hits, you're like, okay, I'm watching a Scream film now. Yeah, no, Red Right Hand, solid song, you know.
We'll see if this strikes a chord. Chances are it will, if you saw this at any point in your life.
Respect, to feel like an insect. Well, don't you worry, buddy, 'cause here he comes through the ghettos and the barrio and the barry and the slum. His shadow is cast wherever he stands. Stacks of green paper in his red right hand.
Beautiful. Yeah, so we just chatted about Scream, 1996. We're jumping 1 year forward in the decade of the day, the 90s. We're going to 1997, Jackie Brown. This is Quentin Tarantino. And tell us a bit about what it's about, because we, Emma and Lily, have not seen it, but Ella and Ava have.
Okay, so the film by Tarantino is actually based on a book.
Oh.
That was published in, published before the film.
Good,
but by
good.
Actually by a different name, which is like an interesting change.
Ooh.
And basically it's about this flight attendant, at least the film version is, Jackie Brown, who helps as part of like a smuggling system, will bring money over from Mexico to her boss, kind of, and then she gets stuck in this difficult situation where she gets caught and she tries to play both sides, with one side being our other protagonist, Max Cherry, who is a bondsman.
Okay.
And so the film is, it takes place, it's like a very short period of time. And it's just her, you know, being a boss-ass woman, which is a really, really interesting thing to see.
Yeah.
In, first of all, Tarantino movie.
Yep, I think this is, like, the only film where he has a female protagonist, really. Like, as the center of the film, which is really interesting, considering the roots of the film, which you've been researching over here, Ella. It's on one of your tabs.
So is she, like, a lovable character, or, like, she's a criminal, though?
Well, so what's so particular about her is that, like, one of the characteristics that I feel like is quite reinforced is, like, how old she is and how she's kind of, like, not, like, outdated or anything like that, but, like, if this doesn't go well, like, she can't start over. She can't do things again. And I feel like that's something that, like, and I haven't read the book, but what differs between the interpretations is that, like, in the book, she's, like, really worried and struggling. And I just feel like in the film, she comes across as this, like, confident and very in control. And she kind of, like, is the one who maneuvers the dilemma. And I would say that she is very likable. But it's interesting because in the book, the character's name is, and I might be misquoting this, Jackie Burke. And actually, Tarantino changes it to Jackie Brown. And originally, she was a Caucasian woman. Mm-hmm. And in the film, she's played by Pam Grier, who was, like, a star of blaxploitation films in the 60s. And so it's really interesting to see her come back from these films and to take a place in a film that actually draws a lot of inspiration from those.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've just heard great things about her. I haven't seen anything with her, but Jackie Brown, I guess, is top of my list now, even though I haven't got super into Tarantino. I know you have a hot take on Tarantino, though.
I do have a hot take on Tarantino.
Give that.
I am, unfortunately, a certified Tarantino hater.
Yeah. What have you seen?
God, I've seen Pulp Fiction, Inglourious Basterds, Django Unchained. I feel like there's a few more I'm forgetting now, but I don't know, I find his work really, it never catches me. Like, I never feel like engaging with it. Like, Pulp Fiction, I remember watching, it was like pulling teeth. Like, I was just sitting there, I'm like, I need this to be done right now. You check the runtime, there's like an hour left. It's just, I don't know, something about his films, like, I feel like I just don't get, they're just not for me, I think. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, he's like, obviously a very, like, you know, I see, like, the cinema of, like, his, like, the, what am I looking for? Like, the talent that he has as a director.
Yes.
He's just not for me, you know, not my guy.
Yeah, that's something we were kind of talking about was, like, his style beginning in the 90s and transitioning into the 2000s changed really drastically, I would say, in terms of, like, the violence that is shown on screen. Mm-hmm. And something I think the violence is definitely way more prominent and used as, like, a motif in his movies in the 2000s much more than it is in the movies that were in the 90s. Like, in Jackie Brown, there's, like, shootings and, like, graphic killings as well. Like, it's definitely a theme in his movies, but for some of it, it's not on screen, which I think in his more recent movies, it's all on screen. Yeah. He wants you to see it, and he's kind of become, like, an auteur for violence in his movies. Like, that is one of the key elements that makes up a Tarantino movie. So we just thought that Jackie Brown is actually a very different style when you watch it compared to the more recent Tarantino films. But, like, we agree that sometimes they're hard to sit through.
Yeah.
And have you ever seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Yeah.
I haven't, actually.
That's the only one I have seen. And it threw me off a lot. I don't think I was ready for it at all. I wasn't ready for the blood. I wasn't ready for a lot that was going on. This feels like something, people are going to be like, what are people talking about on this film show that I can't even handle it? Like, it was not that bad, like, on the grand scheme of it. But maybe this is something, I feel like this, Jackie Brown is something that I'd be able...
Yeah.
Sounds more interesting. And I think there is something to say, like, not just like, oh, they put a female as the lead immediately. Yep. Mm-hmm. Good to go. But I think there is something to say for, like, after watching all these films, especially, like, for you, Emma, like, not really having a great experience. Yeah. Maybe there is something a little bit different, hitting a different beat, reaching a different audience with, like, this powerful female lead.
Mm-hmm.
Jackie Brown could be the film that turns it all around for me.
Yeah. You know?
Well, I also feel like I agree. Like, I'm on the same page as you. I actually don't really enjoy your average Tarantino film, and can come for me for that. But
we accept hate mail.
Yeah.
So don't worry.
Any mail, really.
Any mail.
But something that's really interesting, I just read this article about it, where basically he's talking about, and I don't know how you guys feel about this, because this is all about, like, where you get inspiration. Yeah. But he, like, time and time again in his films, will take inspiration, like, very overtly. And as I talked about before, like, the blaxploitation, like, he would, using songs directly used in those films, using actresses that had been prominent in those films, even kind of, like, borderline themes.
Yeah.
But he will, in his words, it's like, he describes, like, a good artist as, like, a thief, kind of. And it's, like, willing to take those. And I just wonder what you guys think about what, like, kind of like, what are the implications a little bit when a director or someone like that is willing to just, like, overtly be like, yeah, I'm just going to take this. Like, I'm going to take this idea. I'm going to take this image that I've seen before, which we can actually talk about later. Like, for example, the opening scene.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to turn it into my own, but I'm stealing it. And I, like, I don't know.
Yeah, especially in the 90s, like, that seemed to be really prevalent, just as sort of, like, I mean, I know Gus Van Sant, who's, like, we might talk about him later, he did a remake of Psycho in the 90s that is shot for shot the exact same thing as, like, Hitchcock's Psycho. And it's like, okay, well, like, where's the value there, I guess? And then, like, I guess then you get into, like, postmodernism as, like, an idea and, like, oh, if, you know, we've already asked all the big questions, so what's the point in asking more? What's, you know, like, just making art for the sake of making something. And I think, yeah, I think there's a very fine line between, like, just kind of, or I guess there isn't really, like, you know, what is taking and what is referencing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that's an interesting idea of, like, just straight up taking something from this one film, like, plonking it down your own, or, like, referring back to him and, like, oh, yeah, I recognize where I'm coming from, but, like, this is my take on it.
So. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, what is your intention? Like, is it paying homage? Like, are you taking something to what you're saying, like, reference some sort of cultural significance that that element had? Or are you taking it and critiquing it, which is maybe, like, what was happening with some of the stuff that was happening in Jackie Brown?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oops. I mean, yeah. Like, I guess what comes down is to intention, and I guess that also shifts a lot of responsibility and accountability that the consumer has to take on making, like, I don't know, like, looking up where are these references coming from, and, like, is it some sort of, like, oh, they took it and they didn't add anything to it, or are they taking it to use to critique something?
Well, actually, that's another point that I thought was super interesting. This is actually, out of all his films, the film where the N-word is said the most. And he's very controversial for that, right? Where it's like...
Django Unchained.
Django Unchained is a hard watch, for sure, for that reason. And it's... I mean, it comes into, yes, intention. Like, if this is, like, the intent here is to make a critique.
Yeah.
Then, you know, okay, interesting take. But if it's just leaning towards more of, like, a desire, I don't know. I'm not going to explore his intentions. I just think when I watch things like that, I feel like it's, like, it's hard to imagine this as, like, a really strong critique when it seems like he's just using it for some sort of cultural significance or the fact that he can. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think back to, like, adapting scenes from previous films, we were looking at the opening scene, which is when... Jackie Brown is walking, I think, through, like, an airport runway.
She's a flight attendant.
Yeah, she's a flight attendant.
Right.
And so she's against this, like, bright blue wall, and she's in her blue little flight attendant fit. And you were saying how that's, like, a visual reference to The Graduate, right?
Yes, like the opening scene.
Yeah. And then the song that's used is this, like, really iconic song of the soundtrack called Across 110th Street by Bobby Womack, which hopefully we'll play after. But that was used in the film Coffee, which is the one you were talking about, the exploitative film that Pam Grier was in previously. And so I think that connection, that song being in both of those films in different contexts where Pam Grier is playing different, like, completely differently viewed characters, I think brings into the conversation, like, is the later rendition, like her character in Jackie Brown, is that more seen as empowering, or is that still, is she still being exploited in a way? Like, how is, it's interesting to see those like referenced connections between Coffee, which was made in the 70s, and then Jackie Brown in the 90s.
Yeah. I think those callbacks are so interesting. And it also just like makes it more interesting if like you've already seen the other film, and like it's not necessarily an Easter egg, like that's a weird reference, but like I love when there's Easter eggs or like things like, oh my God, I remember when this was used in another film, and like seeing if there was some sort of, was that intentional or is it just a coincidence? And then looking into lyrics and stuff, like I don't know, what is the song really about? We can play it, but across 110th Street, maybe we'll take a listen to it and kind of see what it feels like and see if we catch anything that maybe relates to the story. So this was Across 110th Street by Bobby Womack, you said?
Yeah.
Perfect.
It's played in the very opening scene of the film.
Okay, let's take a listen.
Brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Being down so long, nothing didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you do till you put under pressure. Across 110th Street is a hell of a tester. Across 110th Street, pimps trying to catch a woman that's weak. Across 110th Street, pushers won't let the junkie go free. Across 110th Street, woman trying to catch a trick on the street. You betcha.
Cool. Okay, I totally need to watch Jackie Brown now. Like, yeah. On the watch list it goes. I think it's already on your watch list, Emma.
Yeah?
I think I saw in your letterbox.
Let me pull it up.
Take a look.
Right now. Yeah, this is going to be like call out on air. It probably is.
She claimed she'd never heard of it before we started the episode. This would be so anyway, hard. I like
yeah.
that song.
Yeah,
it's, yeah, on, it's on your watch list. Okay, man. Well... No talking penalty for 1 minute. Guys, I love that song. That was cool. So it's about like crime in New York from what I gathered. And I like a good crime movie. Yeah. And this one's like about different characters. They're trying to find like money from what I've read mm-hmm. about it. I haven't mm-hmm. seen it again. I haven't, but my attention is caught.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, throughout the soundtrack, there's like a lot of really great like funky songs, which is... You know, kind of lightens the mood yeah. a little bit, I think, when you're trying to depict kind of graphic violence at points. Mm-hmm. And over the break, we were just trying to brainstorm how this is kind of in reference to the story. And, I mean, the opening lines kind of say, like, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. And that is definitely in line with how Jackie navigates her situation, because she is a flight attendant, but, you know, she kind of picks up this side hustle because mm-hmm. she doesn't really have a choice in some ways. Like, it might be a possibility to provide a little bit more than her full-time flight attendant job.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, we could connect to that, I guess.
I love it. It was a fun song. On the topic of strong female leads, 90s, how can we not talk about Thelma and Louise? Unfortunately, none of the strong women... in this room, other than me, have seen it. So that's going on the watch list for you guys. But, oh my gosh, it's one of my favorite from the 90s. It's just so iconic. So this is Ridley Scott. Mm-hmm. It's starring Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis. So, like, already, you've got to be kidding me. These are, like, some of the most talented, amazing women ever. And then you put them together, and you get this powerful, like, exploration of a queer love story. And also, like... Mm-hmm. challenging and finding gaps and areas of there's room for hope, but also just like really big critiques on toxic masculinity and relationships, all sorts of things. So Thelma and Louise, basically, for all you who haven't seen it, they hit the road for a vacation. That intention doesn't last long. I won't give away all that happens, but basically there's a series of events and like that vacation gets sidetracked. And the rest of the film follows the two ladies taking jabs at, like, the culture and expectations that surround them as women in the 90s. And it's so amazing. It's so powerful. No one comes to rescue them but themselves for each other, which is what I love the most. There's just mm-hmm. these really, really sincere, genuine moments between the two where, like, one of them has lost their marbles. Not to call them crazy, because so many of the men called them crazy throughout the film. They're not crazy. Like, either way. They lose their marbles a bit. They're frustrated with how they're being treated. They're frustrated with their situation. Mm-hmm. And they're there for each other. It's not someone swooping in to save them, but one of them will just take a breath and be like, hey, you stay here. I'm going to go make this call. I'm going to go somehow get some money for us. No matter how they get the money, you guys will see. And they take care of each other. And it's just amazing. And then you've got all of these like caricatures, did I say that right? Mm-hmm. Of different ideas of the male.
Yeah.
And so you've got these detectives and they're like looking for the ladies because they're basically like criminals as the series of events unfold. And they're trying to find them and they think that they know like how to track a woman or what a woman, how to like find them or what the woman wants to what they want to hear to kind of lure them back to the detectives. But they're also just like the most stereotypically the whole time that they're hunting for them, they're eating burgers, they're like reading erotic magazines, they're watching movies. And these are like the detectives, the investigators, the police. And it's just hilarious to see them. And even we have Hal, who's supposed to be kind of this sympathetic, one of like the lead detectives trying to find Thelma and Louise after the crimes they commit, basically. And you kind of see this part of him that, like, sympathizes with them, wants to save them, sees, like, how they were wronged by the system and how they maybe deserve a second chance. But at the same time, he represents like everything that's upholding a system that is against women and against listening to victims who are women often. So there's a little bit of like a point of sympathy with that male character, but also not. And then you've also got like these overtly like disgusting male characters, abusive, like just gross. But really, like, the centers of this are Thelma and Louise and their friendship for me. And I love the film so much. It's got great music. We'll play a song. But also, just, like, at its heart of heart, this film is a movie on the road. Which, like, I love a good movie on the road. I don't know if you guys have any on the top of your head. But
road trip movies.
Road trip movies are so fun.
Love them. I don't even care if they're, like, terrible, bad. Like, if you say there's a road trip in the movie, I'm watching it. Like,
Paris, Texas has one, yeah?
Hmm?
Paris, yeah. Texas.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we've got. What else can you think of? I don't know. I love this niche.
I think My Own Private Idaho is a road trip.
Okay,
movie.
We'll get into that later. So perfect.
Yeah, but.
And then it's also a crime film, which we just talked about, like Jackie Brown, which I like a good crime film.
Oh, yeah.
And it's also a duo film, which I don't know if you guys are into like any iconic duos, but I was talking to my dad a little bit. Iconic duos. We have Ava and Ella in the studio. How can I not think of that? Woo! But also other iconic film duos like Blues Brothers, Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kids. Even another film I wanted to talk about today was Clerks, Dante and Randall. Hilarious duo. They like, it's just a movie of them working their boring job in like a convenience store, and that's the whole film. It's like an hour 45 minutes, and it's just their interactions with customers. Like, anyone, I feel like everyone who reviews this movie is like, if you've ever worked in customer service or like at a desk or anything, you'll like you'll get it, you'll get this film, because it's just so many funny interactions, whatever. So I love a good iconic duo, and like Thelma and Louise like are the iconic of iconic duos. They're like referenced as a Thelma Louise moment, like whatever. Great movie. I want to play Ballad of Lucy Jordan. This comes at a just beautiful part when they're driving through like these canyons. It's fading between their faces and it's just the music, them on the road. You guys will love this part, especially like if you're a road trip movie lover like Emma. So here's the Ballad of Lucy Jordan.
Keep praying as she sat there softly singing. sun touched gently on the eyes of Lucy Jordan on the rooftop where she climbed when all the laughter grew too loud.
And she bowed and cursed. Okay, that was the Ballad of Lucy Jordan, not to be confused with the Ballad of Lucy Gray Baird, but by Marianne Faithfull. And I really like that song. It's got this fatalistic take that the movie also has, Thelma and Louise, which is what we were talking about, because we're talking about our favorite films or highlighting whatever we want to talk about from the 90s. And we were also just talking about on break some other road trip movies, because Thelma and Louise is kind of a movie on the road. And Ella, you mentioned Stranger Than Paradise, which is from the 80s, but it's an on-the-road film. So add that to your list. And it's from director, writer, whatever, Jim Jarmusch. We don't actually know how to pronounce his last name. So if you're listening, Jim, we're sorry, first of all.
We accept hate mail.
We accept hate mail once again. but we also wanted to talk about Night on Earth, but we don't have time. So sorry about that too, Jim. That's another movie, all takes place in taxi cabs at the same hour, like in the middle of the night, but in different cities across the world. You guys would love it. You'd eat it right up. We don't have time for that. We have time for one last film that we're going to talk about, and Emma's going to talk to us about it.
Yes, I am. It is My Own Private Idaho, 1991, Gus Van Sant. Don't know if anyone's, I don't think so.
I haven't.
Yeah.
I really want to. Well, I'm sorry. I'm
giving her thumbs down. You guys can't see, but.
Yeah, it hurts.
Just picture it.
I know.
But yeah, My Own Private Idaho. So this is a loose, very loose adaptation of the Shakespeare plays Henry IV and also Henry V.
I love this already. Yeah, I love loose so Shakespeare adaptations.
Like, you get these moments in the movie where you're like, oh, okay, this is like a very, like, the wording, the way they talk is very Shakespearean at times. Like, you're like, no one is actually talking like this in 90s Portland. But yeah, these guys are. And that's the beauty of it. So the title of the film comes from the song Private Idaho by the B-52s, which, great song. Yeah, they went crazy with that one. Like, I listened to it earlier today. I'm like, yeah, this is, like, not at all in line with the vibes of the film, but it's such a good song. The film, like, itself is a landmark film for new queer cinema, which did kind of see a bit of a rise in the 90s. Like, you're getting films, like, of the time that are really notable for this movement are Happy Together by Wong Kar-wai, Living End by Greg Araki, and Watermelon Woman by Cheryl Dooney. So it's more of, like, an ideological movement than a stylistic one. It's just kind of, you see this, like, artful exploration around, like, what is gender and what is sexuality, and, like, challenging these dominant ways of looking at it that really come about, like, reach ahead in the 90s. Like, obviously, there were queer films before and there were queer films after, but the 90s is just this really interesting little bubble where there's all these, like artsy, postmodern sort of films about queer topics. It's really interesting that it all kind of came to a head like that. And so this movie in particular, My Own Private Idaho, follows Mike Waters and Scott Favor, who are two sex workers living on the streets of Portland, who go on a trip to find Waters' mother. And the lead two actors are Keanu Reeves and River Phoenix.
That's
and
crazy.
Oh my God. Their performances are insane, out of this world. There's one scene where they're like, they're on the road, you know, and they stop off for a little bit, have a little campfire on the side of the road. And it is just the most heartbreaking scene ever, but in this, like, very quiet, melancholic way that is unique to the film. Like, especially the character of Mike Waters, who's played by River Phoenix, he's just constantly seeking out connection and just being rebuffed at, like, every turn. Like, looking for his mother, and then he's, like, looking for something with Scott, and it just never happens. He's just constantly ending up alone time and time again.
Yeah.
Which is really just, like, that's kind of very much the core of the movie. And I guess another thing about this film is, like, the setting kind of operates as a character. Like, there's so much time devoted to just, like, shots of the setting. And they'll just be, like, oh, just in some rural, like, field.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, multiple establishing shots of it. And there's just something about it that just really, like, makes you feel like you're looking at this, like, snapshot in time. And there's so much time spent, like, building this world that is basically just our own. But you're really looking at it through this lens. So originally, Gus Van Sant wasn't really going to get funding for this movie. No one wanted to make it. So he was going to make it on a shoestring budget with actual street kids as the cast. But ultimately, he secured funding and got Keanu Reeves and River Phoenix. But the street kids do make an appearance. And they kind of, like, there's a scene where they're playing basically themselves. And they're telling these stories about what they've experienced. And it's, like, because they're just talking about their lives on camera. And there is something about this film that feels, like, so intimate. Like, it's almost like you shouldn't be watching. Like, there are times you're like, oh, yeah, is this something that I'm meant to see?
Hmm.
But I think that's part of the beauty, is that you really get a look at these, like, complex relationships between all these different people. And it's just such a well-done movie. I've seen it, like, 3 or 4 times. It's heartbreaking every time I see it. It's, I cannot recommend this enough, especially as, like, an entry point for nuclear cinema.
I'm sold.
Such a good point.
Yeah, and this is one of your favorites ever, but so also one of your favorites of the 90s.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It is making top of both of those lists.
Okay, good. Before we finish off, like, are there any rapid-fire 90s that we didn't get to talk about that you guys are super into? Films from the 90s. We're going to go into a couple other decades later on. At least for me, like, I know that you guys, I don't know, maybe you have, but I love The Truman Show. Like, I would talk about that so much if we had time. Like, I did talk about it a bit on an episode last year, if you guys want to go through the archives on CIDR.ca. But that's iconic for me. Yeah. Clueless is also just iconic of the 90s. Like, huge movements in teen rom-coms. Like, 10 Things I Hate About You, all of those guys. Such a good era for those.
I don't know if this is 90s, but I've been thinking a lot about Wings of Desire recently.
Ooh.
I'm going to fuck up his name. Wim Wenders?
Late 80s.
Okay, never mind then. But it's, it's very much speaks to this, like, later, like, how maybe German cinema is informed.
Okay.
By, like, the late 80 period,
yeah,
80s period, because it's talking about, like, the Berlin Wall.
Mm.
It's just, like, a really, really interesting look into, like, a little bit of a future there. And you can kind
of,
like, see.
Okay,
that,
yeah. I've never heard of it, but it looks super cool. Yeah. And maybe there is, like, some sort of transition into, like, yeah, maybe we got a bit more of that in the 90s. Because, yeah, like, it came really late 80s. So we're squeezing it in. Like, we're honorary, like, 90s.
Cold War.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, yeah, Clerks. I wish we could talk about that more. So good.
90s good. Part 2. We're going to have to do it.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. 90s Part 2. Yeah, let's listen to a bit of the song that you had from My Own Private Idaho, though.
Cattle Call. Eddie Arnold just really encapsulates the whole feeling of the film. Like, there's just such this, like, Western sort of solitude. You're sitting there like, yeah, sad cowboys.
Well, I'm glad we got to end off with one of your top favorite films, top favorite of the 90s, because also you will not be back for quite a few episodes.
This is it. This is it. Say goodbye to me, guys.
Emma's heading home for the summer, but we're back. We're back in the fall, in September.
We're so back.
There are still some more episodes of The Real World. Mm-hmm. Emma's just not going to be here, guys. Yeah. And we apologize. In spirit, yeah. Lots of shout-outs for you. Exactly. Don't worry. We won't pretend like you never were here. And thank you to our guests.
Yes.
Ava and Ella. So
Thanks for having us. Hope we come back next year.
Yes. I hope we didn't scare you guys off. Yeah. We killed that. We love the 90s. Go check out some of the films we mentioned.
Yeah.
And here's Cattle Call from My Own Private Idaho.
The cattle are prowling, the coyotes are howling, way out where the dog is bold. Where spurs are a-jingling, a cowboy is singing this lonesome cattle call.